This is the Arsenal Brothers Podcast.
Welcome to episode 8 of the Arsenal Brothers Podcast. After a bit of a delay, we've gone over a month without recording, so glad to be back home and ready to record another episode. Josh, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's almost like we didn't need to record anymore because we just kept winning games. I mean, Arsenal's on such good form, we didn't really have too much to talk about during it. But it's only when controversy shows up that all of a sudden it's kind of worth having a podcast. So even though our schedules didn't really work out, I'm glad we're finally going again.
Yeah. So what controversy are you talking about here? I'm not familiar.
Well, maybe not controversy, but just the 0-0 draw with Chelsea. Obviously, it's a result that is rather disappointing considering that we came in on red hot form. They had no real recognized strikers that were truly fit. And so, you know, it was a game that if we were ever going to break our duck against Chelsea, I thought it was going to be that game. And I thought we played well enough that we could have won. But it's just one of those games where sometimes the ball doesn't go your way and our players miss the target too often, even though we had great chances. That's what I'm talking about as far as controversy goes. This whole boring Chelsea and Arsenal argument, you know, it's the most fun the media's had in a while with us.
Well, I can't believe the nerve of us to call them boring. I mean, good Lord, that's on par with human trafficking. That's just a terrible thing to do to another group of people, to call them boring. How hurtful.
It's not like we've been called boring throughout our entire history until the Wenger era, really. So, yeah.
No. It's really despicable on our part, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
So, what did you make of the match?
I thought it was boring.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I thought we started pretty brightly. I thought Chelsea was pretty cynical at the start, especially Ivanovic's foul on Sanchez. It looked like he tried to injure him from the camera angle I had. But then Chelsea kind of grew into the match, and they had the best chances, and they caught us with our line too high at least once. And, you know, they went into the match knowing all they needed to do was draw and not expose themselves, and they did the job. That's what they're good at, so... I was hoping for a better result. I was hoping for a goal, but this is basically what I was expecting. I only wish that we had played well enough in the earlier parts of the season to actually put pressure on Chelsea where they felt like they needed to win the game rather than being so comfortable that they could sit back and get a 0-0.
Yeah, I agree. Obviously, we wish we could be in a better position, but I don't think it's any surprise that as our squad got fitter, we played a lot better. I mean, I forget the statistic, but it's something like our fitness levels have correlated with like an 18% increase in points per game or something. And I do think that's a big thing, and I'm hoping that this is partially the work of Chad Forsyth, and thus we might have a healthier squad as a normal thing from here on out. I mean, Chelsea's been incredibly lucky to not have too many big injuries this year. Costa's really the only one that sticks out in recent memory. And so I'm thinking with a healthy squad like this, I think we have a serious chance to contend for the title next year with maybe one or two big additions, where I'm not really sure. But I don't know if we have the squad depth of Chelsea at the moment. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting you bring up squad depth because I think Chelsea has less depth than we do. If you look, I think they have six senior defenders. I think they have Ivanovic, Azpilicueta, the Felipe Luis, and then they've got Zuma, Terry, and Cahill, and that's it.
Yeah, that's true. I guess maybe the depth isn't what I'm thinking, but I mean, Mourinho did say in the news recently that if you give Arsenal, you know, four world class players to go with this great squad we already have, then we should be winning titles. And so I do think we lack a player. I don't know. I mean, I think our spine could be a bit stronger. I think we still need someone who can compete with Coquelin at defensive mid. I think Giroud's in fantastic form, and I think he's a great striker. I just don't think he's you know, top elite level for this record position. And I think we don't really know how good Gabriel is yet. And as Mertesacker and Koscielny add on another year, we might need to reinforce that area as well, hopefully with another top-class addition.
Okay, I mean, I'm not against strengthening by any means, don't get me wrong. This is the first time I can remember at the end of a season where I feel fairly comfortable about the size and the quality of the squad, where I don't feel like we could instantly upgrade any one position, at least in the first 11. I'm not sure we could do that. So we'll see what comes down the pike, I suppose. What did you make of Chelsea's couple shouts for a penalty there? First of all, the collision with Ospina, where Oscar was clearly concussed and they let him play on for the rest of the match.
Yeah, I mean, I think that situation itself is despicable from the doctor's standpoint. You have to think that when he went off the pitch at, what was that, like 7 or 8 minutes, then the doctor would know that he's showing concussion symptoms. And if he's showing symptoms, you need to take him out of the game. There should not be an option to let that player back on the pitch. I mean, the fact that he had to go to a hospital at halftime is just dreadful.
Yeah.
So, but aside from how they treated Oscar, that penalty decision is a difficult one. I don't think I've ever seen one given like that, but it probably should have been given. I mean, yes, he gets the ball over Ospina, and then Ospina does tackle him. So it's not necessarily a goal-scoring opportunity because the ball is already through, but it is a full-body tackle in the box. So while maybe not a red card, I think it probably should have been a penalty and probably a yellow as well. And we're very fortunate that not only Bellerin got back to save it, but that they ended up not calling the penalty either. What did you think of that first one?
Yeah, that's basically exactly what I thought. And that's what the coverage over here in the States basically said immediately. They said that's a clear foul on the box. Not a red card because Bellerin was there to sweep it up. And the ball's already past him, so it's not a goal-scoring opportunity like you said. But, I mean, it's one of those that I think you're right. I haven't seen that call very often either, and I just wondered if it was something that rarely happens or just something that's rarely called. About the concussion protocol thing, what should be done about that? Like, what should... Because Chelsea, I mean, I assume, because Chelsea didn't have any strikers and they were playing Oscar as a makeshift striker, that they left him on for competitive reasons. I mean, anyone could see, and if you watched him the rest of the match, Oscar, he couldn't complete a pass. He was passing it straight out of bounds. It was bizarre. Like, he couldn't do anything. And it was so clear to me that he was messed up that, like, if the Premier League is serious about protecting their players from these head injuries, something needs to be done to Chelsea, and I'm talking about more than a monetary fine. I think they should have to drop a point. Because they're doing it for competitive reasons. They're doing it to save the substitution and try to win the game with their best players out there and jeopardizing their own players' long-term health in so doing. So I think they should be docked at least a point. I really do.
I wouldn't disagree with that as a punishment, but it's an area that I think this is really sparking the discussion on it. And so to retroactively come back and say, hey, you know, you did this thing that we haven't seen before, but is a problem. We're going to duck your point. I don't think that's fair to Chelsea. But
I don't think it's fair to say we haven't seen it before because it happened twice in the World Cup. Like, everyone should have had this fresh on their mind this season.
But I agree
that there should have been some prior existing kind of legislation or that the team should have been notified that if you mess this up, we could dock you points. But I think that's the fairest way to actually legislate this out because
it was
ugly to watch, Oscar. It really was. And I'm a guy, I could care less about Oscar's well-being, to be honest. But I don't like to see people like, look like that. It was messed up.
But I was talking with some of my friends about what could be done in these situations, and the closest thing we could think of was having some kind of neutral doctor assigned to every single game who is trained to make the medically correct call in these situations. And now people might come out and say, yeah, but how do you get an unbiased doctor at these games? Well, the same way that you get an unbiased referee. You know, I mean, you got to think that if they're serious about this, the Premier League should put up the funds to hire these doctors for these crucial injuries. And that then that way no team can really get angry. And I don't know, then we can bring in the question of should there be a medical substitution rule. We can have a fourth sub if it's medically okayed by this neutral doctor. I think that's a good idea. I think you want to see 11 on 11, and if an injury happens, that's really unfortunate. But if it's deemed truly an injury by a doctor, then I think an extra substitution should be allowed.
And to be fair, we haven't fixed this problem in the United States, and our most popular sport has way more concussions than soccer does. And in our biggest event, Julian Edelman was concussed and kept playing. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I think the only way to really crack down on it, you could fine them all they want. I think it's got to be competitive penalties. It's got to be.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I do think there still are good doctors, especially in the NFL, though. I mean, I remember Wettick was telling me that when Rodgers had a big concussion issue a few years ago, his uncle was actually the head doctor for the Packers.
Yeah.
So he had to talk to the team and say, no, Aaron really cannot play this week. He just can't do it. But you need more people like Wettick's uncle to step in and say, you know, I don't care what the team needs competitively. Health needs to come first. And I think that the best way to do that is through neutral doctors.
Well, the problem is the Patriots didn't let Edelman go to the doctor. And Edelman didn't want to go to the doctor because he knew he'd be taken out.
Yeah,
so that's what happened. I mean, you're always going to have that problem, especially in football, because there's so many plays and so much rotations of players that players can just choose not to go see the doctor, as opposed to soccer where a guy's going to be out on the pitch and the whole game stops for him to get treatment. So it's a much different scenario. But, I mean, I don't – my beef isn't with the integrity of the doctors, especially in the NFL. My concern is that the players won't see the doctor because they'll be afraid to take themselves out and risk losing multiple games in a 16-game season. So,
Here's another question for the Premier League then. Would you support actually pausing the clock for injuries?
No.
Why not?
Because it's... For one, I don't want games to go on for 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason. And secondly, I think it's part of the... As frustrating as it is to watch players fake injuries and kill clock at the end of games, it's just part of the tradition of the game. It's part of what it is.
Okay, but how can you expect a doctor to make a thorough medical examination of someone's, injury symptom in a rushed situation where they want to get back on the pitch as quickly as possible because their team is down a man?
Yeah, I know. All I can say is that...
You've got goal line technology, you've got extra officials, things do change in sports, and while the nonstop clock is a major part of the history of football, I do think that there needs to be a discussion about stopping the clock for injuries like this.
I mean, that's a good point. All I can say is the teams might have to play with 10 men for a longer period while the diagnosis takes on. I mean, that's really the only way to do it. If they can't afford to do that, then they have to use a substitution. Like, let's say it's late in the game and they need a goal. Then I'm on the side of better safe than sorry, I guess,
okay, with
that sort of thing. But that's a good point. I just worry about games going too long. To be honest, that's what I worry about.
But the whole stoppage time idea is to,
It should make up for it all. Whatever game it was when we had 11 stoppage time minutes against Liverpool, and Abui did his thing.
Abui was Abui. Yeah. Well, anyways, moving on. What did you think of their second claim with Fabregas' dive, in quotes, in the penalty area? Did Cazorla touch him? Was it a penalty? Was it a dive? What did you think?
I mean, Cazorla touched him, but Fabregas clearly made the most of it, and he knew he did. That's why he didn't appeal for the penalty.
Yeah.
I thought that one was pretty cut and dry. There wasn't enough to bring him down there, and Fabregas threw himself to the ground. So it wasn't a dive because he made the most of contact rather than faking contact, but it wasn't enough for a penalty.
Yeah, it reminded me a bit of Young's dive a few weeks ago where he almost sought out contact. And went down. And that's equally as bad as diving. Well, it is diving technically. But I originally thought it was a true dive until I think it was Gary Neville pointed out, like, look, Cazorla's already saying he didn't touch him before he sees that Fabregas is on the ground. So he knows that Cazorla knows that he did touch him. It's just a question of how much did he touch him and did Fabregas make the most of it. And so, obviously, I'm going to say that Fabregas did make the most of it because it was hilarious to see him get a yellow card for diving at the Emirates. But overall, you know, that's a difficult call, but I think the ref got it right.
What did you think of the reception that we gave Fabregas in general?
I'm as conflicted as the response was.
Yeah.
I mean, you had people like cheering for him. You had people booing him. It was a very, you know, half-hearted boo, if anything. Nothing like Adebayor, nothing like Van Persie. I don't know. It's difficult because he was such a big part of this club for so long, and the fans really did love him when he was here. It's still really strange to see him in Chelsea colors instead of Arsenal colors. And I think the mixed reception shows that we acknowledge how much he did for the club, but also have to treat him as an enemy player now because he's at Chelsea. And it's also harder for me to blame him, considering I do think he would have preferred to move back to Arsenal, but then just probably came back.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I don't know how to look at him. I hate seeing him play for Chelsea. I hate the situation more than the player, I think.
Yeah.
But the player's pissing me off now, too. He's been at Chelsea for a year. He's going to win the league with Chelsea, and I don't like that. So,
yep.
I don't like anyone who does that.
Exactly.
All right, well, let's move on. Position of the week. I think this spring has seen the final settling of Mesut Ozil. I think we're finally seeing his best after the transfer. And I thought, despite missing that late chance where he whiffed at the ball at the near post, I thought he was immense the entire match against Chelsea, especially when dealing with the kind of challenges from Azpilicueta and Matic. He was stronger on the ball than I can ever remember him being, and so accurate with all of his passing. I'm really encouraged by how he's played this spring. He's really been first rate. How about you? What do you think of Ozil right now?
Yeah, I think hating on Ozil is so 2014 now, which is great. You can finally put that behind us and acknowledge that he is a phenomenal world-class player. And I think you're right in the Chelsea match. He was on top form in that game. And you can see just how angry Matic was that he had to mark Ozil. He was going all over the pitch, left and right and center and back and forward. And Matic was visibly exhausted from marking him the whole match. And yet he still pulled off some incredibly good balls. I think I remember when the Ramsey in particular, that was incredible. But yeah, I think we're seeing what we shelled out $42 million for. You know, this is a world-class number 10. And I think, you know, right as you were talking about the Fabregas, you know, issue, I think Ozil has relatively proved Wenger right and shown that Ozil is as good, if not, well, I'd say he's better than Fabregas. And so I understand Wenger's decision to not bring Fabregas back, especially considering how good Cazorla is going to be as well.
I do think it's apples and oranges. They're different positions. Fabregas is best as the deeper line playmaker that he's been for Chelsea, lofting those balls over the top. That's what he's best at. And that's what he assisted Costa with one, and then he damn near assisted Oscar to beat us twice. I mean, I'm not going to back down on we should have signed Cesc. I'm not going to back down. Even though Cazorla's been amazing this year, I think Cesc would have been a better version. And if you look at Cesc's assists this year for Chelsea, he puts Ozil to shame. I mean, it's not even really close. So, I think Ozil's one of the best number 10s in the world, but I think Cesc is one of the best number 8s. I really do.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I didn't want Fabregas. Obviously, I still wish we had signed him. But I do understand, I guess, as much as I don't like it.
Yeah, no, I understand it too. I just don't think that... To me, a lot of people bring up that argument, and to me, there's no reason why Cesc and Ozil couldn't have played in the same team together, because we're seeing Cazorla and Ozil playing the same team together every week. I mean, I think Cesc would be a better version of Cazorla. As great as Cazorla is, Cesc is on another level.
Yeah.
So that's uplifting, talking about Sask. It's not what I intended. I wanted to praise Ozil. Ah! as far as youngsters coming up in Ozil's position, do we have any that we should be aware of? I mean, it's maybe just Wilshire and Zalalem?
No, actually, Dan Crowley.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you've seen much of him, but we bought him from the Aston Villa Youth Academy 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think Bleacher Report just ranked him as the top prospect in Europe out of 50. So he's
Bleacher
a great...
Report?
I know, it's Bleacher Report. That Chelsea had like 10 kids in the top 15. I was like, really? But no, Crowley is quite good. I've seen some videos. I haven't seen him in person. But from what I've heard, he's been great in the England youth setup. He's been great in the Arsenal youth setup. I think Zalalem is more of a number 8 and Crowley's more of a number 10.
Okay.
But we'll see how he develops. You know, you don't want to hype him too much. You know, I don't know if he's going to be, you know, like Odegaard and practicing with the senior team soon or something. But, I don't know if there will be a gap between Ozil and Crowley or if, you know, we'll give Wilshere a chance up there or, you know, we'll buy someone else to be up there. I'm not really sure. But Crowley does seem to be the most promising prospect we have.
Okay. Excited to see him play maybe next year in preseason.
Yeah, that'd be great. We'll see.
All right, well, let's look ahead now. We don't have a game on the weekend. We are Monday Night Football, Arsenal, and Hull City.
The Hull City Tigers.
Yeah.
Did you see their midweek match against Liverpool?
No, I didn't. I saw Chelsea's. That was it.
Yeah. Well, Hull managed to win 1-0 against Liverpool in a pretty much deserved victory.
Liverpool's shit, though.
Yeah, I mean, they've been in good form since the new year. It's dipped recently. But Hull, I mean, Steve Bruce, this is what he's good at. Is he'll get teams into those, you know, 15, 16, 17 positions and keep them in the Premier League. Looking at their lineup, I mean, gosh, I know very few players in there. But, you know, they've got, like, El Mohamedy. They've got Ndoye, who's been really good. They've got, I think, oh, gosh, who else? Like, I mean, Chester, Davies, you know, Bruce, all these different players who don't seem like they'd be Premier League players, but he makes it work with them. So I think they're a respectable opponent. I think we should still win. But I think they're still fighting, you know, tooth and nail to stay up. What do you think?
Where are they in the table right now, do you know?
They just won, so I think they're in, like, 16th.
15th?
15th, yeah. They left above Villa.
Yeah, wow. They're almost safe, aren't they?
Almost yeah.
I mean, well, I shouldn't say that, because it's still so close down there. But
yeah, cool, because Leicester's won, like, 4 in a row.
Yeah.
Except for they lost to Chelsea, of course, but...
Yeah. No, I think it's tough. I wonder how they'll play. Against Liverpool, you said you watched it. Did they do their kind of same old five at the back system?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And Dawson scored the goal on a header. And I mean, we saw in the FA Cup final last year, they love a corner, they love a set piece, and they're pretty good from them, and you have to hand it to them. But they're probably going to sit back and try and absorb pressure. And this is where, you know, Ozil and Cazorla really need to come to play and find those spaces to play Sanchez and Giroud into the box and get them shots on goal. So I'm confident that we have the ability to score on them. I think we might need a goal in the first probably 50 minutes to feel relatively comfortable. But we do have to respect them as an opponent.
Yeah, I feel pretty confident too. Only because I know we went there late in the season, late in the spring last year, and put forth a really good performance where Aaron Ramsey scored at least one very, very good goal. And Ozil played well there too. I'm a little worried just because I think the result against Chelsea and then Chelsea's win midweek could be a little bit deflating to the psyche of the team. They might feel like they don't have anything to play for anymore. But there is plenty to play for. I mean, finishing second place, for one, it's a lot more money than finishing in third or fourth place. And two, it'd be the best the first time Wenger's finished, or Arsenal has finished, not just Wenger, the whole club, has finished in the top two since the Invincibles. Mm-hmm. And number three, we wouldn't have to qualify for the Champions League, which would be very nice. So I hope we win. I think we'll win. How about a prediction? What do you think?
I think I'll say 2-0, with both goals coming pretty close together in like the 60th minute or so.
Okay.
How about you?
3-1.
All right.
3-1, with Giroud, a brace for Giroud.
My fantasy team would love that.
That's what you call a brilliant segue, folks. On to the fantasy sports talk. And Josh, I'm giving you your opportunity. For some reason, draft fantasy football hasn't hit the UK like draft fantasy American football dominates US sports. Explain what draft fantasy football is, and explain why it's more fun than having a league where everybody in the damn league owns Harry fucking Kane.
Exactly. So instead of receiving a budget of $100 million and then buying players, you know, based on your own value estimations of, oh, this guy's overpriced, this guy's underpriced, which then leads, like you said, to everyone fucking owning Harry Kane and Charlie Austin. And, you know, that gets kind of boring because people end up having the same teams and it's not as competitive. So the draft fantasy football for the Premier League is a traditional snake draft style, where if you have 8 players, you go pick 1 through 8, and then person in the 8th position gets the first pick of the second round. And this way, each player is only owned by one person in the league. And for those of you who haven't tried a snake draft system for American football or baseball or the Premier League, I highly recommend it. A lot of my friends over here got interested in the idea because of the show The League. They really enjoyed it. They wanted to be a part of something like that. And so we found one of the few draft fantasy football league websites available. And so we signed up, and we're doing our own head-to-head scheduling and stuff because the site isn't that good. So that's actually a good business opportunity if anyone wants to start a draft fantasy Premier League site. There's definitely the market for it, I'd say, and no one has taken it yet. But as far as how the standings go, we drafted, I think it was 6 weeks ago now, and there are 8 of us in the league. We're going into week 7, and our playoffs are actually going to be a 2-legged semifinal and then a Champions League-esque final in week 38. So this is the last week before playoffs. And I'm currently sitting at 3-3 with the second best point differential and second best point scored in the entire league, and yet I'm still sweating that I might not get in. So I'm going head to head against my friend Shinji, who's also 3-3. The winner basically gets into the playoffs, and then the loser has to go down into the relegation fight, or as we call it, the notable named disaffectionately for our student body president at LSC, who none of us really get along with. So none of us want to win the Nona Bowl, because obviously that means you lost the entire league. But as far as my team goes, I've got, if I can pull it up here, I've got Giroud, Lukaku, and Connor Wickham, actually, is my third striker who's on the bench right now. And then I have Ramsey, Ozil, Hazard. And then I just picked up Ramirez, because if Oscar is still out, I think Ramirez has a strong chance to play against Crystal Palace, especially with the speed of Bolasie and Zaha. I think that'll be important to track back. Then I've got Grealish on the bench in case he decides to start assisting and scoring goals for Aston Villa. Then my defense, I have Trippier, Terry, Baines, Mangala, and Alderweireld. So a pretty strong defense. And then in goal, I've got De Gea and Guzan. So I think I have a pretty strong team, but the person who scored the most in our league, my roommate Gareth, he got tremendously lucky by trading for Bolasie and Kane, giving away Fabregas and Costa the exact week that Bolasie scored a hat trick. So one of my other roommates, Sam, for 2 weeks in a row, he had someone score a hat trick against him, and he was furious about it. And this is what's so beautiful about draft fantasy football, is you get completely fucked by another person having one player who just goes off and scores a shit ton one week, and then all of a sudden you're screwed. I've lost most of my matches by like a couple points, which is really frustrating, but I have faith that I can win this week. Most of my players have good matchups, Arsenal at home, you know, Chelsea at home to Crystal Palace. I really think I can do well here. But yeah, so that's why I think draft fantasy football is better than the traditional style. But obviously, it's up to you what you want to do.
All right, well, there you have it. Draft fantasy football, folks. So, hey, if you're a big league executive at ESPN.com or Yahoo.com, something like that, you got a great, great idea for your Monday morning meeting.
Exactly.
You do exactly. Right now. We'll only charge 25% commission. That's
exactly.
All we'll charge.
We're giving
on
you
all
the
ad revenue. On all the ad revenue. And, of course, exactly. I get 20. Because I'm the older brother.
Well, yeah.
That's how this works.
All right, well, let's move into the U.S. Sports Talk of the Week. The topic this week is the NFL Draft. We had the first round last night, so the first 32 picks happened last night. And about a day or two ago, Joel, you sent me an email where you decided to really, really nerd out over the draft business, and you decided to make your own mock draft and predict exactly what was going to happen. So why don't you talk us through what you thought might happen in the draft, and then where you think what you went wrong on some of these.
Oh, I was way, way off. I don't think I got five right, honestly. I don't think I did. I got the first two right. Well, kind of, even though I said I don't even know what to make of that. I mean, I thought it'd be fun to just try and see if I could do better than all the talking heads. And all the talking heads only get like five right, too, so it's really not that big of a deal. But, I mean, I got the first two picks right. Pretty much everybody did. And then after that, I got a lot wrong. I really did. But I suppose if we're going to go over what happened, we should start at the top with Jameis Winston, the number one overall pick. I found it kind of funny that major character issues were found with guys like Randy Gregory or Shane Ray, who smoke weed. And Jameis Winston has a rape charge against him in Florida that he's still going to have to see court time for. And that's not a major character issue. I mean, it's bizarre to me that the way, especially after Ray Rice just last year, how the way that the NFL's turning a blind eye to this guy's record. But as far as a quarterback prospect, he's a good prospect. He's an amazing leader by all accounts. And when he played with Kelvin Benjamin in his freshman year at Florida State, he was by far the best quarterback we've seen since Andrew Luck. Now, last season, he threw 18 interceptions, and the reports I've read said he probably should have thrown more. There were a couple interceptions that were dropped by defenders. So I think his decision-making on the football field is suspect. I think his maturity is obviously suspect. I don't think he's ready to be a face of the franchise type of guy. And honestly, I can see this going poorly. But if you had asked me before or after he won the national championship as a freshman, I'd say this guy was the best quarterback I've seen since Andrew Luck in college. So it's weird. I don't really know what to make of him. How about you? What do you make of Jameis Winston, and how do you think he'll do in Tampa Bay?
Yeah, well, I mean, I haven't done too much research on, you know, the draft or any of these players, really. I mean, I saw a little bit of Winston when he was at Florida State, but from what I have heard, it seems that he's very often been kind of worryingly compared to a DeMarcus Russell. And a lot of people are saying this, and my worry, and when I heard, I think it was Stephen A. Smith or someone saying, was that it's unfortunately almost entirely race-based. Just because they're kind
it's
of
lazy.
Larger black guys, they think, oh, Winston must be exactly like DeMarcus Russell.
Russell had a much stronger arm.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, an incredible arm. He could throw it 80 yards on his knees. I mean, that's why he was the number one pick. The potential there was incredible.
Yeah, definitely. But I think from what I heard, he is about as good of a prospect coming out of college as you can get compared to, you know, he's almost like an Andrew Luck, kind of like a Peyton Manning even coming out of college. But, you know, going back to that Manning draft, you know, people thought Leaf was going to be a great prospect as well, and he flopped. So, I mean, I think Winston is a great talent. I hope he succeeds in Tampa Bay. I think he's got good receivers there. He's got Vincent Jackson and Mike Evans, who I think are two, you know, above-average wide receivers. But yeah, I do think
they're great wide receivers.
Oh yeah, but I mean, yeah, Mike Evans was incredible this year. I thank God that I had him on my fantasy team. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it will come down to how well he can learn defenses, learn how to read the pro game, and I think it's going to be an especially interesting first game of the season. I don't know if you saw this, but first game of the NFL season, Tampa Bay against Tennessee, and
Mark. Is it really?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. So moving on to Tennessee, then they drafted Marcus Mariota, or as Commissioner Goodell called him last night, Marcus Mariota.
Oh God.
Mariota.
Domo Arigato.
Arigato.
Can't win.
Yeah, Goodell. He makes $45 billion a year to do what exactly? It's ridiculous. Anyway, so the Titans, a lot of people wanted this kid, Mariota. Cleveland was in for him. Chicago, the Bears were in for him. Philly, his old coach, Chip Kelly. That old gunslinger, Chip Kelly. They're all trying to trade up for him. Tennessee said, no thanks. They're bringing him in. Now, Mariota is a system QB. Josh, can you explain what a system QB would be?
Well, I mean, part of what's made Oregon so dominant in college football has been their ability to teach to a system, to find players who fit their ideal offensive scheme, and thus they have success. So at Oregon, it's largely been relatively dual-threat quarterbacks who can make short passes in the spread game and who are able to make quick decisions and scramble if necessary. And Mariota fits that to a T.
So, like, for an example, if you're watching a system college team play in football, you'll see them, their coaches hold up signs for the plays, and the quarterback doesn't make any decisions as far as calling plays of the line of scrimmage and anything like that. They normally run their offense incredibly quickly to try to tire out the defense and get open looks for their wide receivers and running backs in the passing game, or use a lot of misdirection with their run plays, trying to fake the defense into thinking they're going one way and going the other. And Mariota's, I mean, we've seen system quarterbacks get drafted into the NFL. Probably Robert Griffin would be the most recent example of someone who would get drafted, who got drafted this highly, and he was successful. He ran the Rookie of the Year his first season, but couldn't hold up, and now it's looking like he's really struggling to grasp the basics of an NFL offense. Colin Kaepernick, early success, struggled to grasp the basics of an NFL offense. Tim Tebow was always a joke.
A case in itself, yeah.
Yeah, that's not even... Yeah.
Back at the Eagles, baby.
I saw that. I don't understand. So, maybe he's finally willing to play fullback or something.
Did you hear about his contract, though? No money guaranteed.
Well, he doesn't need it.
So, well, yeah, but they're giving him a chance, basically.
Yeah.
If he earns his way onto any position.
No lose for the Eagles there until it comes time to cut down the squad, and then you don't want him wasting one of your roster spots. So, exactly. I mean, it'll be a good story in preseason, I guess. But all right, so basically Oregon has the most efficient offensive system in all of college football. They have had it since Chip Kelly installed the system. Kelly is now the Philadelphia Eagles head coach. And Mariota has been the best system quarterback I think we've ever seen. I think it's fair to say his numbers are better than even Griffin's were. What's weird to me is that when you watch him, he doesn't have an accurate arm, and what made him so valuable at Oregon was the fact that he could make plays with his feet. That so often his receivers were so wide open he couldn't miss. He never had to throw anyone open, and even when he couldn't miss, he did miss some throws. So I think it's interesting that he went to Tennessee in particular, because Tennessee's head coach is Ken Wisenhunt. And Ken Wisenhunt basically is known throughout the league as a guy who kills young quarterbacks, especially young mobile quarterbacks, and really does his best work with veterans. So I don't like this pick for Tennessee. I think they should have taken one of the trades and tried to help their team elsewhere and hold out for maybe a QB in next year's draft. And I don't like it for Mariota because that's if I'm Mariota, that's one of the worst coaches I could play for coming out. And I know Matt Leinart, who's another Heisman Trophy winner from the Pac-12, or I guess back then it was the Pac-10. Matt Leinart has gone on record multiple times saying Ken Wisenhunt kills young quarterbacks. And he really, really doesn't like him, which is interesting to me because Leinart had a promising career ahead of him until he went to Arizona and played for Ken Wisenhunt. So we'll see how Mariotto, or whatever his name is, we'll see how he plays out. But I don't know. I'm not very I wouldn't be very enthused if I was him to be heading to Nashville, that's for sure.
Well, it sounded like in some of the pre-draft kind of hubbub that Mariota was impressing people with his intellect almost as much as Russell Wilson did from a few years ago. Do you think that's a fair comparison? They both seem to be relatively mobile quarterbacks. Maybe the accuracy's not there. But do you think he has a chance of being a Russell Wilson, maybe if he changes teams? And then also on Ken Wisenhunt, did he draft Jake Locker? Because he's also kind of died at
Penn. He didn't draft Jake Locker, but he killed him. He put the final nail in.
Okay.
No, I think Russell Wilson's completely different. You can tell with his demeanor, too. Wilson's a very nice and very smart guy, and I think in that sense, so is Mariota. He's very nice and very smart. The difference is Mariota seems very shy in every interview I've seen with him, whereas Russell Wilson is this charismatic, engaging guy, and he just, you can tell he's a leader. The moment you watch him speak, you can tell that people get behind him. And Mariota looks like a guy whose head coach has been calling all his plays for the last 4 years. I just don't see the leadership ability. Even Winston, I see it. With Mariota, I don't. So, we'll see. I just think it's a really bad situation for him. And maybe if they get rid of Wisenhunt this next season, because he's been pretty poor, I gotta be honest. Maybe things will look up for Mariota. I don't like these system QBs. I don't like these guys that have played in a system that overproduce compared to the skill that the quarterback actually has. Moving down the list to who is my favorite player in this whole draft, which is saying a lot because he's from Alabama in the SEC, which I hate. Amari Cooper is an Oakland Raider, and all of a sudden the Oakland Raiders are drafting incredibly intelligently these last 2 years. Amari Cooper, now buckle your seatbelts here. I'm going to take the comparison train for a wild ride because I think he's Jerry Rice. I really do. I think he's so polished. He's so quick. His hands are impeccable. He's a great route runner. And I think Rice was about the same size. I really think there's the potential there for Cooper to have that sort of career if Derek Carr works out as the Oakland quarterback. I mean, he's not the super athletic freak like a Randy Moss or a Calvin Johnson. He's just going to be a solid receiver who's always going to be open. Always. And that's going to work. That works a lot of the time. So I'm a huge Amari Cooper fan.
Would you say he might be comparable to a Reggie Wayne?
He's twice as fast as Reggie Wayne.
Okay. Okay.
And he has better hands.
But, okay, so here's my worry, because I also agree that I think Cooper's one hell of a prospect. But I worry that he went to the one team that has a history of drafting these talented, athletic players out of the drafted skill positions. And then they managed to not go anywhere.
The old Raiders draft Kevin White because he had a faster 40 time. That's what the old Raiders do. These Raiders are smart. Khalil Mack was the best pick in the first round last year. Khalil Mack is going to be a dominating edge rusher for the next decade. And Derek Carr, arguably, was the best quarterback taken in all the draft last year. You can make an argument he was better than Bridgewater, better than Bortles. Manziel.
Yeah, true.
I mean, these Raiders are drafting well, and you know who they hired, right? Ted Thompson's old their GM is Ted Thompson's old assistant, Reggie McKenzie.
Really?
Yeah, he's got a Packer background.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're not dumb. They're good now. They're gonna develop. All right. I know. Oh, I'm kind of excited to cheer for him because I like the Broncos.
Yeah, it's about time that kind of woke up.
Yeah. I mean, they're one of the coolest teams in the NFL. The silver and black, hell yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because who else do they have in these skill positions now? Because Maurice Jones-Drew is retiring. So
yeah,
they've got McFadden still in the backfield?
No, McFadden went to the Cowboys. They brought in Trent Richardson, 2.0.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
2.0 yards per carry. Trent Richardson, 2.0. That's bad, but they also, towards the end of the year, this burner, Latavius Murray was his name, he came on strong towards the end of the year. He's like a 6'3 guy who should be playing wide receiver, but he has no hands, so they put him at running back and say, run around the outside, and it works.
And so, I remember Marcel Reese played pretty well, I think, 2 years ago when he was called upon. They always seem to have kind of surprise.
And they got James Jones. James Jones had a good season for them last year. Andre Holmes isn't a bad wideout. They need another one, and I think they get another one probably tonight in rounds two or three.
Did they still have Rod Streeter?
I don't think they have Streeter anymore. I don't know what happened to him. Okay. They've cycled through a lot of them. I think a lot of them end up getting injured or something. But no, I think these Raiders, we'll see what they do tonight. But I like what they've done in the last two drafts, and I think that's all it takes in the NFL. String two or three good drafts together, and all of a sudden you're a playoff team. It's really all it takes.
Yeah.
Moving down from Cooper was, I think, the biggest surprise in the first round. Brandon Scherff, number 5 for a guard.
Yeah.
Scherff's a Hawkeye. What do you know about Scherff, Josh?
Really not much, other than he was a big bright spot for the Hawkeyes this year. Obviously one of the best, if not the best, linemen in the country. I have always thought that drafting O linemen in the top 5 usually does help your overall record, even though it's not a flashy pick.
Drafting left tackles does.
Yeah, true. But the Joe
not interior linemen.
Okay. So, I mean, where's your evidence of that?
Well, it never happens. I mean, the best teams, I think the Cardinals drafted, I think, Jonathan Cooper, maybe 7th a couple years ago. And he's stunk. I mean, the two best guards in the league are Marshall Yanda on the Ravens and Josh Sitton on the Packers. And Yanda was a 3rd-round pick. Sitton was a 4th-round pick. I mean, interior offensive line, especially, is a position where you can get a guy in the later rounds and still have a very, very good interior offensive lineman. Like Corey Linsley, 5th-round pick, was a great center last year. And that's not the only example of that happening. It happens all the time. The Lions, Larry Warford, I think, was a 3rd-round pick. He's one of the best. He's one of the best guards in the league. I just think it's really high. And the Cowboys got a lot of credit for drafting Zach Martin with their 1st-round pick last year, and he's the same type of guy, a guy who played tackle in college but has short arms, so he's going to have to transition to guard in the pros. And I know a lot of people love Zach Martin because he went to Notre Dame and then he went to the Cowboys, and they're two very popular teams. But if you look at their production, Zach Martin was the worst lineman on that line.
Mm.
And he got put all pro because he was all the hype was around him, the 1st-round pick. The guy on the other side of him, Martin was the right guard. You know the guy on the other side of him, the left guard?
No.
Ronald Leary is his name. Undrafted free agent. Better player. You don't need to spend something as valuable as a top 5 pick in the draft on Zach Martin. They could have traded completely out of this pick and picked up 2 first rounders in like the next 2 years, the Redskins. And then they could have got a guy like Laken Tomlinson or something late. They could have traded up for him late. Like, and he's probably a more polished guard prospect than even Scherff, because Scherff looks like a risk in pass blocking, to be honest. He's going to be a mauler. He's going to be a great run blocker. But I'm not sure he can pass block. We'll see. I like Scherff. He won the Outland Trophy. He was one of the few bright spots on Iowa's football team this last year. But 5th is crazy for a guard. It's just not smart. It really isn't. Personally, I don't think you should take a guard or center ever in the first round, ever. I've seen too many good guards go later that it doesn't make any sense to me. It's harder to get impact players on defense or left tackles. Left tackle is a guy. Or even right tackle. Tackle, in particular, on the offensive line. It's a different story because you need more athletic ability to be able to pass block and protect the edge. That's why it's different.
All right, well, let's move down to the number 10 pick, where the Rams decided to take Todd Gurley out of Georgia, running back, and almost promptly, Zach Stacy has said that he wants out. What did you make of this pick by the Rams? Do you like Gurley? Do you like the pick, or what else should they have done?
I don't like any running backs in the first round of the draft. I don't. I think it's dumb. I think the league was smart when they stopped doing it, and now they're getting dumb again. And St. Louis is really dumb, because St. Louis is missing 60% of their offensive line. They don't have a starter at center, right guard, or right tackle. They have five running backs already on the roster, and their running game was decent last year. Trey Mason was a rookie last year, was very good. Benny Cunningham, not a bad backup. And Zach Stacy, he's just a two-year pro, and 2 years ago, he was averaging 100, 120 yards per game. I mean, it's incredibly stupid. Not only do you not need a running back, you drafted a running back who's currently has a torn ACL, and you're putting him behind a line that's going to get him injured. He's going to be taking hits in the backfield every time he touches the ball. Like, address your line. Everything starts with that line, and they don't have a tackle. And take that tackle 10th, or trade down and pick up a guard 20th. You know what I mean? Like, they are a terribly run team because they have a dominant defensive line, one of the best defensive line in all the NFL. And that's all they have. They haven't been able to supplement it with anything on offense or on defense. They have a bad secondary, bad linebackers. They just have four good guys, and they've had that for the last 2-3 years. They haven't been able to add on to anything. I don't know what they're doing. I want to root for them, but I can't. They're terrible. I don't know. It's a good thing Stan Kroenke, I don't know. His NFL team is completely hopeless. It's a good thing for him, I guess, that Arsenal's showing signs of life.
Yeah. Well, he's just concerned with getting them to L.A., although it looks like the Chargers have basically said, go fuck yourself, San Diego. They're about to go to L.A., so we'll see.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, they're talking about a possible shared stadium between whoever, the first two to go there, but it would only be two. Yeah. Oakland would stay in their crappy stadium? Oh.
Yeah, no, I think it was Oakland and San Diego would share, then the alternate plan was a Rams independent stadium. So I don't know what's going to happen. But it does look like someone's going to move down the next few years.
Really? Okay. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, in honor of Hamish's Pittsburgh Steelers, I figure we should talk about the Steelers and their draft. They drafted Buddy Dupree.
Buddy Dupree.
Kentucky.
Deja.
Oh, come on, bud. So Dupree is a guy who basically was a third or a fourth round pick until the combine. And just blew scouts away with his numbers at the combine. He ran, you know, he was strong, he was fast, incredible athlete. Pittsburgh really needs an athletic pass rusher. I'm shocked, personally, that they went with a guy like Dupree rather than a guy like Randy Gregory, who's a much better player, production-wise. I mean, Randy Gregory is one of the five best players in this draft, production-wise. He was outstanding, and as soon as he declared for the draft, they actually had him as the number one pick right away, ahead of Winston, people thought he would be. He's got major character problems. He tested positive for marijuana at the combine, which is not a good sign when you're an athlete supposedly in your best physical shape preparing for that sort of event. But as far as Dupree goes, I think this is interesting. I think it's basically the Pittsburgh coaches betting on themselves to be able to develop Dupree's athletic skill set into a productive football player. Because as of yet, he hasn't shown to be a very productive football player. And I'm sure you haven't seen or heard of Buddy Dupree until today, but neither had I until a couple days ago. So that kind of tells you what you need to know about a guy like that. But
yeah.
We'll see. I mean, Pittsburgh has a history of developing linebackers. They haven't done it for a while, but maybe they'll get it right with Buddy Dupree.
All right, well, then let's move on to the number 23 pick, where the Broncos traded up and drafted Shane Ray, who was arrested for marijuana possession on Monday morning, 4 days before he was being drafted, and yet still got drafted in the first round, and not only in the first round, but to a state where marijuana's legal. That's amazing, right? What did you make of the draft pick?
I thought it was pretty interesting. Elway, the GM of the Broncos, he went out and said that he had rated Shane Ray as the 10th best player on his board. And that would make sense to me only because Ray is one of the best pass rushers in this draft, especially when he gets his hand down as a defensive end in a 4-3. His first step, his burst out of the three-point stance, is incredible. I mean, he is so fast right away. He just takes off. What's weird to me is that Denver switched into a 3-4, so they're not going to need a 4-3 D end anymore. Now he's going to be transitioning into an outside linebacker in a 3-4 without his hand in the ground, with, you know, standing up. I'm not sure he'll have that explosiveness anymore as that in that position, and he's never covered anyone in his life. And playing that role, you have to cover people every once in a while. So I think Denver fans, and my best friends are Denver Bronco fans, they put a lot of blind faith in John Elway because they just love him, because he's a legend for the football team. But he's been pretty crappy in the draft these last couple years. The last two first-round picks he's had, Sylvester Williams and Bradley Roby, both have just been kind of situational defensive players. None of them starters. Neither of them starters. And then in the second round, he picked Monty Ball, who's a bust. It's fair to call it now. Monty Ball is a bust. He's not a good running back. When C.J. Anderson, who's an undrafted free agent, does better than you when you get gone injured, you're officially a bust. They picked
C.J. Anderson was third choice. Ronnie Hillman was the
second. Yeah, Ronnie Hillman, yeah. Too. Oh, okay.
So, yeah. No.
Still, they were better than Monty Ball, who they picked three picks ahead of Eddie Lacy, who's already a Pro Bowler. Cody Latimer was their second-round pick last season. If you're wrinkling your eyebrows, it's because who the heck is Cody Latimer? Evidently, he went to Indiana, the football powerhouse that is the Indiana University. He's a Hoosier. And last season, he had a combined total of 2 catches for 23 yards, which was just a little bit worse than the guy picked 8 picks after Cody Latimer, which was Jarvis Landry, who's now going to be a starter at the Miami Dolphins. I just think Elway's kind of a crappy evaluator of college talent, or whoever he's employing to do that for him has been crappy at it. And all of the good work he's done has all been in free agency, and that's not a sustainable way to run a football team. So once Mr. Manning retires, I think you could see a lot of the support for Elway kind of wane and wane every season that they finish 4-12.
All right, well, let's move from one team with questionable draft strategies to another team with probably even more questionable draft strategies, which is the Indianapolis Colts. Already stacked at the wide receiver position with T.Y. Hilton, Andre Johnson, a free agent that they just picked up, Moncrief, Fleener, and Dwayne Allen, they decided to go and draft Dorsett with the number 29 pick. What'd you make of it?
This is a horrible pick. This is awful. This is ridiculously bad. Philip Dorsett is very fast. He ran a 4.340. He's also about 5'11", 185 pounds. So he's T.Y. Hilton. That's what he is. He's the exact same player as T.Y. Hilton. You don't need two of those. You really don't. You only need one slot receiver, especially when you plan to play two tight ends pretty frequently. It's kind of stupid to have more than one of those. Keep in mind the Colts just lost in back-to-back playoffs to the Patriots, where the Patriots ran over 200 yards, I think, in both games. The last one was 45-7. I mean, they needed help in their front seven to stop the run. They can't do it. They're terrible at it. And they got a crappy version of T.Y. Hilton. Like, even if you're going to take a wide receiver, swing for the fences with Dorial Green-Beckham. Or even if you want a deep threat, get a guy who has better instincts as a pass catcher than Devin Smith from Ohio State. Philip Dorsett? I mean, to me, he reeks of Troy Williamson or Darius Hayward-Bey. These other guys that were just burners at the combine but didn't produce in college and didn't produce in the NFL because they're not good football players. They're just athletes. So I think this is easily the worst pick in the first round. Easily. Especially when a guy like Malcolm Brown was still on the board. And lo and behold, he goes to the damn Patriots. The Colts' nemesis in these last couple of years in the playoffs. So I just feel bad for Andrew Luck. Andrew Luck is a once-in-a-lifetime type player. He's going to end up being one of the best quarterbacks we've ever seen. And right now, the Colts have had him for 4 or 5 years, something like that. They've completely failed to surround him with the type of talent that he needs to really push on and win the Super Bowl. It's a credit to him that they've been as successful as they have been these last couple of years, because really, the Colts have Luck, they have T.Y. Hilton, they have Vontae Davis. That's it. I mean, they have three really good players, and the fact that they can get to the playoffs every year, the fact that they could get to the AFC Championship game last year, it's all a testament to Luck, because this GM isn't helping him out whatsoever, especially because he spends more of his time, it seems to me, that he spends more of his time bitching about the Patriots deflating footballs than he does actually scouting college talent and getting a good evaluation. So that's my rant about the Indianapolis Colts for the day. Didn't know I'd do that when I woke up this morning. But that's what it ended up being. Any other picks you want to talk about? Anything else?
Well, I think we have to mention Green Bay pick. You know, yeah. this free safety out of Arizona State, who looks like he might be playing cornerback for us largely.
Correct.
What did you make of that pick? I saw on Facebook Chris Wallace was arguing that I'm blanking on his name. Was it Randall or Russell?
Randall. Demarius Randall.
Supposedly Randall was the best of kind of a bad bunch at Arizona State, and that's why he was being played relatively out of position at safety instead of corner. Do you think this is a case of Green Bay kind of unearthing talent that no one else thought to draft so highly?
Yes. The backstory on Randall is Randall went to junior college. His freshman year of junior college, he was a center fielder. He played baseball. Then he switched to football his sophomore year, went to a different junior college in Phoenix, and played corner. And then he transferred to Arizona State, where Arizona State didn't have any safeties. They had graduated all their safeties. And they said, hey, you're a good two-year stopgap at safety. And guess what? In our system, in Arizona State system, they blitz all the time, and they never give safety help to their corners. So they play a ton of cover zero, and so a free safety in that system is a corner. They're playing man-to-man. That's what they do. They didn't play zone, and they didn't give safety help like a cover two or a cover three, anything like that. They blitzed all the time, and their safeties played man. And this guy, he is so freaking quick. His like burst to the ball when it's in the air is incredible. He's really, I mean, I didn't see this coming at all, because I hadn't done my homework on him until after the Packers took him. I saw he was a free safety, and he was projected to be an undersized free safety, and I said, well, you know, maybe it'll be a second round pick, but nothing special. And then I did my homework on him after the Packers took him, and it seems to me like he's definitely more of a corner. The thing that worries me as a fit for the Packers is that he seems more like a slot corner, like an inside corner, just because his size isn't typical for an outside guy. Although I think he also reminds me a lot of Sam Shields, to be honest. So I like it. It took me a while to like it, but I actually really like it. And the Packers' cornerback, their secondary coach, is very good. And I think this Randall kid has the athletic ability and the coverage instincts to really really make an impact. And we needed a corner, so I think it's a good pick.
Awesome. Well, let's hope that that does, in fact, turn out well for the Packers. And let's hope for even better draft picks over the next couple days in the second to seventh rounds.
Yep, these are the rounds that matter most. Not the first. The first is all the glory, but these are the ones that matter most. So, hoping for some good picks here. I would love it if Dorial Green-Beckham dropped to the Packers in the second round, because he has got some Randy Moss about him, that's for sure.
All right, well, yeah, I'll definitely keep an eye on him.
Okay, well, that's all for this week. Hopefully we'll be recording on a more regular basis, weekly basis, moving forward, or something close to that. I know you've got finals coming up.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
Whenever we can, we'll try to record. We'll try to do it once a week, but thanks for tuning in, and you will hear from us another day. Bye-bye.
See ya.